Mudball.
Oh, Mudball. Look at that. Gosh, Mudball. 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 Again.
We're back for another Mudball Monday.
Mudball.
Been thinking about a lot of Mudballs today. Had the tour on, playing at the old Caves Valley, which we'll get to momentarily, but they've obviously had a lot of rain throughout the week, so multiple Mudballs going on today. Had some great Mudball call-outs. I don't understand why the announcers feel the need to, like, protect the golf course or the game of golf or the Mudball in and of itself. Like, you know, Bryson hit the one on whatever hole it was, had a 4-iron in, straight in the water. And all of a sudden, all the announcers are like coming to bat for the guy, or excuse me, going to bat for the golf course, saying, what's he getting mad at? Like, why is he calling a mud ball? It's like, because there was mud on the ball and that's what happens. It flies God knows where, and it happened to fly in a lake, but they were just acting as if he was completely out of line to be blaming a mud ball. Anyway, we're here to talk about Mudball Monday. And speaking of Caves Valley, we're going to do it.
The Foz.
We're going to do it. It is time to talk the Foz.
And the Faz.
I have a nickname for him that we'll get to later. But I can't think that this is the only time that we'll do a full dive. Maybe not the deepest of dives, but a dive for sure on the Foz. But this will be our first rendition of diving into the Foz. So where I want to start with this is just to talk a little bit about other people's opinions of the Foz, the broader golfing community's opinion of the Foz, and how that has been substantiated by golf course rankings. Now, you nor I are big ranking people. I don't see the value in trying to compare Cypress Point on the coast of California with Shinnecock Hills on the coast of Long Island in New York. Completely different offerings of golf courses, completely different designers, properties, etc. They're both amazing. Why we need to say which is better, I do not know. That is my very quick thought on rankings. However, many people do care about rankings, and Mr. Fazio is someone that has had an interesting foothold in the rankings for really his entire architectural career, which has spanned 35, 40 years at this point. He's been in the game for a long time. Yeah, I was on. So 60 years. Most of his more well-known designs have come in the last 25 or 30. And in that course of his career, he has spent time as someone that has had more courses than anyone at the top of rankings, and not necessarily at the top, but in terms of quantity of courses in the top 100, 200, however you're going to put it out. And he's also been at times someone that does not have a lot of courses. So where we sit in the current day is, if you look at the Golf Digest rankings, which is not my favorite ranking system, it is a group of golfers that pay to rate courses and do not necessarily have to have a deep knowledge of course architecture. Now, there's something to be said for a ranking system by the people, not necessarily by full-blown aficionados, but there's also something to be said for their lack of expertise. So he has about 15 courses in the 2021-2022 Golf Digest top 100 in the United States. In the 2009-2010 Golf Digest ranking, he had also about 15, precisely 15. I don't know why I'm saying about, because the number is 15 in each of those rankings. Now, what's interesting is that you'll see a good handful of courses that have stayed in for the last 10, 12 years. However, 8 of those 15 courses that were in the 2009-2010 Golf Digest ranking that were designed by Tom Fazio have left and have been replaced by other Tom Fazio designs, all newer ones. And to the point being that a lot of his courses don't necessarily maintain their stature that they're perceived with earlier in their career as a golf course. Now, if you look at the ranking system that I personally prefer, the golf.com ranking, which only came out last year, this is a smaller pool of raters, and they are the likes of, I'm not going to name any names, but course architects who obviously have a very good handle on what makes a good golf course, and also golf course aficionados who have played all, most if not all, of the top courses in the country and the world, and in the greater golf course architecture community are very well respected thought leaders, and it's only about 60 or 100 people. So anyway, I personally prefer that ranking system a bit. People can see it how they see it. In that ranking, he has four courses in the top 100 of the US. In the top 100 in the world, he has zero. He has designed over 200 courses worldwide. I think in most people's eyes and ears, he would be one of, if not the top golf course architects over the last 20, 25 years. And so an American architect, over 200 worldwide courses, four courses sit within the top 100 of the US, zero in the top 100 in the world. That is going to be my opener on the Foz and how he is perceived more broadly. Let's bring it to the tie. Mr. Simas, I'm going to kick it to you. The Foz, where are we going?
What's up? It's good to be here. The Foz has been someone that we've had lots of discussion about over the years. I'm going to take a little bit of a side view on something that you just opened up. We talked about courses that Foz has designed, but one of the things, very contentious points here, is let's talk a little bit about the clubs that he's the consulting architect at.
I didn't know we were going to go here this fast, but
namely,
here we go.
Namely, Augusta National, Pine Valley, Cypress Point.
I'm gonna stop you. Well, actually, go ahead, and then I'll cut in a minute.
Yeah, I think there's a story we can share here. But you know, there's a time for everyone, and people sort of come into their points of power, and they eventually lose over time. And I think Foz will go down as one of the best case studies in golf course architecture and history. I don't think of Foz personally as a golf course architect. I think of Foz as a businessman, and he is great at that. Talk about a dude who knows everybody. I cannot go anywhere in the world of golf and not hear the name Foz tossed around. And it's really funny hearing the different opinions that people have about him, both about the way that he can design a golf course. I've heard stories in the golf course architecture world about
a golf course, a Fazio golf course.
Yeah.
It's a thing. Like, you hear people say, I moved here 10 years ago when I knew that there was going to be a Fazio golf course.
Well, you know, it's going to be green. You know, it's going to cost about $60 million to construct. You know, it's going to take a year and a half too long to complete.
And if you don't know shit, you know, it's going to be unbelievable.
And you also know that whoever's enticed about this is retired.
Yeah.
So that's, I guess that's my piece too on the Foz. Where do you want to go with this, Henry?
Well, you know, I was going to end with this actually, but things never go the way you think they're going to go, especially on Mudball Monday. So I'm going to throw it in right here to say, first and foremost, you listed Augusta,
yeah,
Pine Valley, and Cypress. He is off the pedestal at Cypress.
Just pick. Okay.
So no longer. He is on the outs at Pine Valley. The new consultant has been named. We're not going to go into detail on any of these things, but he is out there. And Augusta, I think it's safe to say the writing is on the wall.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about two things here. And this first piece I truly mean, which is to say there is a lot to be said to some of the points that you made about him being a businessman and knowing everything about how to build a golf course from a business standpoint and viewing being an architect as his job and something that he is meant to financially have a lot of success from. Fazio, over the last, 30 years, and I think you could probably draw a line a handful of years ago that it has ended. But for a long time, the vast majority of the 2000s and even dipping a bit further back, he has been the paradigm of golf course architecture and has financially benefited from that massively. And again, there's so much to be said for knowing how to, if you want to say gain the system or whatever it is, if you become the paradigm in whatever you do, regardless of how good what you're doing is, you've done something impressive. You have been very smart and savvy about your craft. And I truly can do nothing but tip my cap as much as he cares to Mr. Fazio for how well he has done in being the paradigm over the last 25 or 30 years. However, there is also a ton to be said for posterity. And what I think is unfortunate at the highest of levels is that the architects that are now taking over the game, Tom Doak, Gil Hanse, Bill Corr and Ben Crenshaw, Andrew Green, the list goes on. I don't mean to not include anyone there, but there are many more.
And the list, and the list is deep. We're very optimistic.
Yes,
about the future of golf course architecture.
But what I think is unfortunate is that most of those guys, not all of them, but most all of them, are more or less implementing design philosophies that we saw 100 years ago, the golden age of golf course architecture. And so for Mr. Fazio and another few architects over the last kind of 30, 40, 50 years to have created... many of that go under the name Jones. For them to have created this whole new paradigm that now is just completely out of style and we're reverting back to what was done 100 years ago, it seems as if we've just wasted a lot of time and we'll get to this. A lot.
Boatloads
of
money.
So, again, this is going to be my closing thought, but I'm going to throw it in now. And I'm going to quote a fantastic film, The Dark Knight, that you either die a hero or you live long enough to see yourself become a villain. And maybe Fazio's work has not yet been vilified, but we're darn close to the point to where people are talking about some of the things that he's done as it's just not good. We've wasted a lot of money and a lot of time on a lot of great golf courses and pieces of property that now we're having to spend more time and more money to fix those problems. And it really is just that we're fixing problems. You know, I was in preparation for this conversation, which has basically been, 12 years of preparation on our parts. But the last few hours, I was on his website looking at his list of courses, his resume. And, obviously he lists his originals, but then he also lists courses that he's consulted at. And, maybe you could just blame the website architect for this, if not fixing this earlier, but there are so many big names on there that he, I'm not like calling BS on it, but he has done work on so many courses that have gone through a massive rehaul in the last 3-5 years, because like that's what needed to be done. I mean, Oak Hill, Marion, you mentioned Cypress, I'm blanking on a lot of the other names that stuck out to me, but I was just blown away at how many courses. It's like, really? This guy that we perceive to be like one of the best and for years, probably the single best, worked on these courses. And now they've put in like millions of dollars on the, not as many millions as maybe Foz did, but still lots and lots of money with these new guys to fix more or less what Foz did. And we've created almost this whole new term of not renovation, but restoration. I think that's almost where you can like draw the line of when we went from the Foz paradigm into this new one. Is in the Foz age, it was renovation. It was, oh, so we had these golden age principles. We had these golf courses. They were great. We loved them. They've been at the top of all these lists for years. And let's go in and let's renovate. Let's see what I can do.
That's exactly.
And now, right, all of a sudden, we have all these new guys come in that have studied the works of the golden age architects who left us with such great golf courses. And we are restoring. We were returning these great courses to what they were over 100 years ago, because we need to, again, restore from what Fazio and others renovated.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just, what sense does that make? You know, why did we need to go through these multiple iterations where, you know, I feel bad even saying some of these things of like, because if you put all that together, it's almost like, well, the guy did nothing for us except for push us backwards. And that's just truly, it's truly not the case when it comes to, because we'll get to that of like, he's built some great courses or some.
And a lot of people have played the game because of Foz.
I'm retracting the word great. He's built some very, very good golf courses that I enjoy, that you enjoy, that many, many people enjoy. However, a lot of his work that's been done on tip-top places, I'm not there for it. And the fact that we now have to get to this restoration phase where the new age of architect has to come in and restore it to what it was a hundred years ago, it seems like a lot of wasted time and money to me. So from someone that knows a lot about time and money when it comes to golf course architecture and more than I do for sure about the history, Walker, what more coverage can you provide on kind of what I've gotten into there?
Yeah, you did a great job. I mean, the golden age was a special time, but we knew that it wasn't going to last forever. And what happened with the Industrial Revolution just carried right into golf course architecture, really, which is, how do we sell large plots of housing developments to people? What do people like to live around? And if we're selling large swaths of housing, what do we need to make it look like we're not building large swaths of housing? Well, that's green grass. And so Foz was really the guy that came in and built these golf courses that made these housing developments feel like amazing places. And while he wasn't the guy doing the bad ones, Foz somehow collected this unbelievable network of individuals that had ownership of large pieces of land and seemingly budgets that were bottomless in terms of building these sorts of land. And I think, Henry, I think you said it perfectly, which was, what can I do? Which is exactly the opposite of the trend in golf course architecture and construction now. I think Gil is probably the best at this that we hear. He's the most selfless in terms of the media when people talk to him about his projects, which is like with any of his restoration projects, you'll never really hear him take credit for what he does. He says, we're merely just trying to put back together what the architect had envisioned or put together in the past. We're merely trying to find what was already there. And Faz was not that, man. He was pretty much the complete opposite. And I think what is probably the most telling is what's underneath the ground. So we have spent the last 20 years trying to put back a lot of the pieces of what golden age, proper golden age architecture was. And a lot of that is you can see that from aerial photos, right? You can exactly. see the bunkers go back. You can see the evidence of what was and what is now restored. And the talent of Gil Hance or Doak or any of these great guys who are out there right now is really the modern drainage systems and the modern agronomy paired with the old school architecture. And that seems to be the best combo that golf has ever seen so far. Now, what to me, the recipe, the evil potion that caused a lot of the problems that we hate today, golf being too expensive, golf taking too long, a lot of these were caused by this sort of trend that FAS was a part of in the late 1970s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, which was, you know, $2 million fees for building a golf course, and then the endless amount of stories that I have heard through building golf courses, which is just absolutely no regard for budgets and not the short-term effect of what a budget is when building a golf course, but the long-term effect, what it's going to cost to ride 9 holes with your son. It's not that redoing this hole is going to cost, you know, $500,000 more. It's that not only is it going to cost $500,000 more, but we're going to have, you know, 30% more problems associated with it. It's going to require 60% more maintenance. And it seems like there was nowhere close to the amount of care gone into that than what goes into things below the ground today. And so for that reason, I am not his biggest fan. And I'll just leave it at that.
I have like 5 times within that piece there, I was like, oh yeah, I'm just going to launch into that. And then it's like, oh, but this is better. I'm going to launch into that. No. So I'm going to try to give the greatest hits of my thought processes as you spoke there. First thing, kind of as it goes along with the money chat, you know, a lot of the newer guys, it's about how good can I make it for how little?
Of course.
And that seems so logical to me, right? Like buying a car, how good of a car can I get for how cheap of a price? You know, if I'm buying a meal, if I'm buying a house, I'm always trying to get the best for the least. If you read about, you know, a lot of these courses, a lot of the bigger name courses that FAS has built, like the tagline becomes, oh, and we spent $25 million to build this, which is more than the last. And just on the 16th and 17th hole, and I'm referring to the Vintage Club, I believe it was, out in Palm Springs, spent $1.5 million on these 2 golf holes. And so I'm kind of sitting there seeing that, like, what are we doing? Like, why is that what we're hanging our hat on? So that's thought one. Thought two, along the same lines, I'm confused with FAS, like, truly would love to hear how that never developed over the course of his career. Because, you know, you can liken, and this is something we do often here at the Tie, you can liken a golf course architect to a chef. And a golf course to food or a restaurant in that.
Oh, dude. If a chef ran his restaurant like FAS ran a golf course architecture project.
Fucking, it's like a Las Vegas steakhouse.
Do you know what the ownership would be doing? Oh, my gosh.
But just before we really go crazy on that whole concept, like what I think of is when you track these, like these great chefs, you know, the truly transcendent ones, they all seem to follow a pretty similar narrative. You know, they get into food, they start working in kitchens, they become a chef, they start somewhere good. They're like, hey, I'm really good at this thing. They continue to get better. They start to recognize, okay, what makes really, really, truly great food? It's great ingredients. Okay, I need great ingredients to make great food. They get the best ingredients because they're now the best chefs, and now they're making the absolute best dishes. They do that for a while, they burn out. They recognize, okay, this is not for the every man. And what do? They all in some way take a step back and say, how can I bring my great cooking to more people? because not everyone can afford the very, very best ingredients in the world. You know, can I make amazing dishes out of A5 Wagyu and tuna that's been caught 2 hours before? Absolutely. But not everyone can afford those ingredients. So how great of a cheeseburger can I make in the case of a Sean Brock, who's just opened up multiple sort of casual restaurants in Nashville and other areas, or, you know, a David Chang that now is like packaging a lot of food that people can order for much, much cheaper than what they might be able to get at some of his top restaurants. Other chefs have started, you know, cafeteria sort of services, like school cafeteria food, because that's where things start. And so, point being that for him to never develop from like, all I want to do is absolute tip top dollar into something more, it just kind of confuses me. Thoughts?
Yeah, his son has taken over the business now, and he's kind of out. Doesn't care as much. He cares about, I think, the name and the business, but his son is off running it. They're going to do stuff that's more international, which in my opinion is, I could overshare here. I'm not going to. I think international is where you can definitely skirt a lot more boundaries, and you can keep the margins as high, because when you expand your scale, you actually can find people that are willing to pay more than $60 million for a golf course. And labor is cheaper, and not in the moral way. So
we're drawing the line there.
Yeah. I don't know what his actual involvement is going to look like after this, but in terms of the company, I think they'll keep going, and I just don't think their involvement in the States is going to continue very much. And I think, shout out to these new firms who are not new necessarily, but, the Dokes and Hanses and of the world, who are just really setting the standard for what high quality construction is now. And I mean, high quality construction, not only what our golf courses look like. I mean, that, let's put that by the wayside. I'm talking about how we pay and treat our people, what our drainage systems look like under the ground, not screwing our owners so that they have to go back and do, you know, another $3 million renovation every 5 years. I'm talking about doing quality work. I mean, being hired to like do quality work. I mean, what I've seen at Lido and heard of from guys on site, I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, it is class A architecture and construction. I mean, it is like, it's how stuff should be done. And it is because of that sort of work that's driving out the poison that was in the industry before. So
I want to jump in really there on important. One thing. I thought that I had been working on here for a few minutes, but also want to jump back into something you talked about a few minutes ago. But on the point of these newer firms and the way that they're doing things and doing things in the right way. Another thing, we got to get to some more positive stuff here, and we will before then, you know, launching into more negative stuff. But anyway, another thing that's just been kind of gnawing at me is like that the word I used earlier of posterity. So I can understand why Pete Dye was not for everybody. You know, his golf was extremely technical. Now, and strategic, Alice. And Alice, yes. Strategically, his golf was great, unquestionably, but it was technical and it was difficult and at times a bit confusing. And you know, it took a pretty good architectural eye and certainly a good player and thinker to understand that the bind between the technicality and difficulty of his courses was like one in one, you know?
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, what you cannot knock Pete Dye for in any way, shape or form is his tree of architecture, which is to say you look at the top designers of today, and somehow you mentioned Leto, but somehow the name Tom Doak has yet to enter the chat here, but it now makes its entrance. Tom Doak, Gil Hance worked under him, Bill Kaur, God, my mind is just not very good today, but
tons of guys. It's unbelievable how
many guys I think start. It's
something around like 45 guys is right. Like the total umbrella.
So if you talk about who he's a father to and grandfather to in terms of guys that have worked directly under him, I mean, Pete Dye is truly the grandfather of modern day architecture. And Dr. Fazio, on the other hand, I mean, Mike Strantz, RIP, did some great right. work, worked under the FOS. I'm sure that there are many names that we're going to forget. But what I do know for sure is that if you dig into the Pete Dye architecture tree, there are not many names. And, you know, if you extrapolate it out to the courses that they've built, there are not many great courses out there today that have either been restored or built that did not have some tie to Pete Dye. And unfortunately for Mr. Fazio, that does not ring quite the same. Now, to go back a little bit, something that you said that really interested me is you talk about aerials and how aerials really are the essence of restoration. That's really what we have on a lot of these golden age courses is, okay, what did they look like from, you know, however many thousand feet up? And I think that also has a direct correlation with strategy, because in terms of like point A to point B, or, you know, you think about basketball, just Dean Smith X's and O's, it's an aerial view. We're looking at, okay, here's the tee box, here's the green, here are the bunkers, here are the trees, and how can we navigate our way? Now, that's not always a perfect way to navigate a golf course, right? Like, you do need to blend that sort of scientific approach from the air with an artful approach of, okay, well, what does the course present to me from the landscape? But what I want to touch on with that word directly is, do you think that Fazio's architecture, and maybe kind of the last 30, 40, 50 years, being that you have worked in both golf course architecture and now currently within landscape architecture, do you think there's any correlation between this sort of renovation and kind of last 50 year mindset of architecture with landscape photography? So what I mean by that is these guys looking at it just as, I'm going to go out to the site and take a look at what this golf course already has or what this site already has, versus looking from the air and from topographical maps and thinking about it a little bit more strategically with just what the land presents to you rather than just what the eye wants to see, if that makes sense. Trying to make it look really pretty before you make it strategically work.
Yeah. One of my biggest knocks on, if we're just going to talk about architecture, that's it. Then I have a pretty specific knock on the Faz's work. And it's a pretty simple take, which is just that he gets 90% of things right. He clearly knows how to get the end result of construction done. The fairways look fine. Look, all of his courses are immaculately manicured. Now, most of this is because they have incredible budgets and they must hire great superintendents who take care of their properties. But, you know, the fairways look great. The bunkers are usually constructed nicely with good drainage, and the greens roll beautifully and the tee boxes are leveled, and 90% of the stuff is right. But something that you and I talk about a lot, and you can call it shot values, you can call it whatever the hell you want to call it, but the reality is when you're playing golf, you know how to play golf, and particularly when you're a better player, there are hazards on a golf course for a reason. And those hazards are actually very, very expensive to put in. Every bunker you see, the greens are very expensive to put in. Just like every degree slope that you have on a green, it, like all of these things cost money. Everything that you've ever noticed on a golf course costs money. Most of the time it's completely artificial. It's been constructed, particularly around the greens. And the shot values are off. The angles are off. The risk reward is off. And to me, these are the very, very simple things, because
house theory
to me, when you are designing a golf course as a golf course architect, that's where you start. Because it's the beginning point of, okay, how do we construct a hole that is intriguing architecturally, that gives an advantage to a player who thinks? And with Faz's work, it's so confusing to me, because, you know, let's talk about the caves really quick, because I have a few examples from the caves, and this is going to be difficult for our listeners because we don't have the hole right in front of us, but hopefully our listeners who are watching the tournament this week, we'll take hole two, for example. Hole two is like the first water hole. There's water along the right. I'll just paint the picture for our listener here. It's a par four that is largely straight off the tee. There's a giant pond on your right side, and you drive it dead straight. And then the hole kind of meanders along the left side of the creek, and the green sits right there on the creek. Right there on the pond. Now, any architect worth their salt would use the pond as the hazard. And so what they would do is they would say, okay, the hazard's here. The hazard's not going to move. We need this water for drainage, for irrigation, whatever. So we're going to put the fairway slap up against this hazard, which is pretty much immovable. Okay, so how do we incentivize the golfer to play up and challenge the hazard in order to gain an advantage? If I'm an architect, that is what I'm thinking, bar none. Now, what would I do in that scenario? Okay, I would angle the green so that the player that takes on the water has a better angle into the green, some sort of advantage. And the beautiful thing about architecture is that there are a million ways to get this done. You're not limited. There are a million ways to get this done. And now I'm sure Fazio, like any other golf course architect, there are problems that you deal with on site that I'm not going to know about, that you're not going to know about, that anyone listening is not going to know about. But the beautiful thing is there are a million ways to get this done. And what ended up happening is just unacceptable in my view. So let's talk about what actually got placed there. The player who takes on the water's edge and hits a ball right down the right side, taking on the water, is rewarded with the worst angle on the entire hole into the green. They have the skinniest approach with a bunker in their way. And let's talk about what the player has to do in order to get rewarded. There are two bunkers, and I say this, there are two bunkers on the left side of the fairway, which is the incorrect side of the fairway, based on how the hole should be played. There are two bunkers placed there, one behind the other, which means that some guy spent 2 weeks constructing, draining, filling a bunker with sand. It's absolutely redundant, makes no sense. Now, you have to fly that essentially 1 yard short of the bunker to get the best angle into the screen. It makes no sense whatsoever. All right. Some of the things that we've talked about today, cost. They probably could have built this hole way cheaper. Strategy's way off. And it doesn't even, for what? If you're just going to mess up two of the most important principles,
at least make it look good.
At least make it look good. And it, you know, it looks all right. It looks, and that's a case study right there. And I can go through 14 other holes at the caves alone.
We need to get to video quickly, because I wish people could have seen the way I've reacted to what you've said the last like 3 minutes, just in my idiosyncrasies and my face.
Have you been looking at it?
No, I've just been thinking about the 30 other examples of Fazio holes that are exactly the same story that I've just like beat to death for years of like, you know, 13 at Congaree, 16 at Quail Hollow, 18 at Quail Hollow. I mean, so 18 at Quail Hollow, let's go there because that's a hole that a lot of people are going to know.
Yes.
Now, okay, let's start with this. 18 at Quail Hollow, final hole of a championship PGA Tour golf course. Is it hard? Yes. Is it going to bring out some big numbers? Yes. Is it hard to make birdie? Yes. Is it hard to make par? Yes. So does it check a lot of the boxes for being a good finishing hole on a big championship golf course? 100%. Cannot knock it for that.
90%.
Yes. Right. It's an amphitheater. You know, you can fit a lot of people in there. And maybe that's where we're just wrong. Maybe that's where Foz's courses are supposed to just kind of be that. They're supposed to be 90%, but they're not supposed to be the truly great ones. But I don't think anyone ever strives for 90%. So let's just pretend that we're not wrong there. Okay. The hole has a creek on the left side of it, and it has a big slope to the left of the creek. So we're not hitting it left of the creek. All right. That's not a thing. It has a bunker along the right side. It's
why
kind of a dog leg right to left ish, but it's very simple that if there's a creek on the left side of the hole and we're not going to go left of the creek, we should be enticed to pull that ball up against the creek and have the very best shot from there. You should have to be very, very valiant to hit your ball up along that creek. Now, when you do hit your ball up along that creek, what actually happens is you have to contend with even more of the creek coming into the green. You have a much worse view because of that into any of the pins on the green. And the way at which the green is angled gives you the worst possible approach if you hit the most valiant drive. Where you have the best angle and the best overall shot is the further right you go. In fact, if you hit it in that bunker, if you're a pretty decent player, it's really not that deep of a bunker.
That's where all those tour guys are aiming,
the bunker. You just don't have that hard of a shot. So that's kind of like Quail Hollow number 18, 1.0. Now, what have they done over the years? I'll tell you what they've done. They've recognized that it's kind of screwed up and that it didn't work. Instead of reworking the green, kind of creating a better angle to where, okay, let's give people a better look if they do hit it up the left, let's just toss in some trees on the right. So now when you bang it right, you're in the rough, maybe in a bunker, and you've got trees. Because, yeah, trees solve problems. Like, you can't hit, yes, they may be 90% air. There's a funny little correlation there between 90% air and 90% right. maybe Fazio,
pretty good.
Maybe he just leaned into that of like, ah, trees are 90% air. My golf course is 90% good. So perfect. Let's just add more trees, baby. Woo!
Let's like, why hire someone that'll do it the right way?
Right.
When we can just buy some hardwoods and throw in some saplings.
So that's just, yeah, I think we've gone far enough there that like, yeah, the 18th at Quail is another good example. It just doesn't work. You know, you talked about a lot of the things are right, but he didn't really do the early stuff. I'm going to go back to a chef. Okay, what does a chef think of? Like, I'm making a plate of food for dinner. There's going to be a protein of some sort on the plate. There's going to be a carb probably, or a starch or something of that nature. We're not going to get into dietary preferences here, but to cater to the vast majority of people, there's going to be some sort of a protein, a carb source, hopefully a vegetable, something green, hopefully quite a bit of color. It's all going to start to come together, but we begin with those very big decisions. We finish with the garnish. We finish with, you know, some sort of a reduction and something that you swirl around the plate to make it look really nice. We finish with, okay, what are we going to plate it on? That might come early in the thought process, but those are some of the last things that we do. What do we not do? We don't start by saying, man, people really like steak. People also really like chicken. People also really like shrimp. Well, okay, let's put them all together. So my nickname for Foz, he's surf and turf. Like, surf and turf is...
He's a Texas burrito.
It's like, surf and turf isn't bad. You know, steak and shrimp, that's not a bad meal, but it's like, it's not, it's just not great. And if you think that that is like the peak of eating, like, it's just not, you know, that's cake and donuts. Like, no, you figure out how to make one of them really, really great and have it be the star of the show rather than say, well, more stars makes a greater show. And now, is surf and turf like the peak of eating? No. Is it really good? Sure. Absolutely. And that's Fazio. He's not making peak golf courses, but he is making good, really good golf courses at times. But that's where we're at. We're doing surf and turf over and over. It's a solid fillet. It's five nice shrimp, but it is not like a truly world-class dish that has one protein or something of that nature that's the star of the show with the proper accompanies and proper garnishments. Words, tough.
Been a tough day.
You get the point. You get the
point. I'll pivot you for a little bit there. Let's talk about salt, fat, acid, heat for a minute. You're making a dressing or something.
Mm.
And I think it's important to note that in cooking, you can only mess up quantity, but there really is no excuse for getting the balance wrong. Just add more of something if you're off. You know, if something's too sweet, like add a little vinegar. Just like you need some pop, you need some salt, add it. And maybe end up with too much salad dressing, but whatever. And the thing about Foz is that he strikes me as a chef that makes like all of the play. Like he's one of those chefs that does like large scale preparations where like 500 people are coming to dine and every plate is the exact same.
It's a massive Las Vegas steakhouse.
Yeah. And it looks pretty good, but like it's always underwhelming. Always. It is.
And then all of a sudden it's like, man, everything. Yeah. It looks really good. Like it passes the eye test. It's all there. You know, it's this steakhouse. It's in a super nice casino or whatever.
Yeah.
But then it's like, wow, man, that's a shit. It's a $65 steak and salty or like, I want a medium rare. Like this is medium, you know, it's like,
yeah,
those are the most basic things. And somehow over and over, it's like, man, it's just not that good. And I paid a lot of money for that.
But just think of the best meals that you've ever had. It was that small little restaurant on the corner that just blew you away because it had some spunk in it, you know? And that's what we want from a golf course. It's not that it has to work everywhere. That's the whole point, is that like, if you're playing a little golf course in some little valley in California, it doesn't have to be anything else. It just has to work right there. And the architect needs to understand that and he needs to care and nurture for it. And if that's what's done, that's all that it takes. You need a chef, if you will, to just care and nurture for the ingredients that are there in that one little place. And if that's what happens, then that's all you need for a really great product right here and there. And, you know, if I hate to say this, but I feel this way, not only in golf course architecture, but in business in general. It's like once you get too big, your shit kind of starts to stink. You know, it's like once you get too big, it just kind of starts to lose its edge. And I think it's so nice to have stuff small and kind of in its own little box. That's where all the best stuff is. Best meals, best golf courses. That's where it all is. That's my take.
It's just, it's so, yeah.
It requires the small care. Things.
The boot just has to fit. And that's all.
It just Foz, needs, I'm sorry.
It needs to fit. And you don't need, you know, you don't need a snake skin and alligator leather boot. You don't need both. You don't need surf and turf.
You don't need surf and turf. That, I think that's the title for this episode. So Foz doesn't search his name on Google tonight and get pissed off at us.
We're not done yet. There are a few more things I want to discuss.
All right.
And if people turn us off at this point, that's fine. I want to talk about where we started, actually, which is the fact that so many of his golf courses have debuted in such flashing color. So a lotion club is an example.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to get the year right, but I'm going to be close. I believe it was the 2007-08 Golf Digest Top 100 that I looked at. That a lotion club sat at 14th in the United States. Where does a lotion club now sit in the Golf Digest Top 100?
Um, 89th.
It's a little higher. I believe it was 47th. Where does it sit on the golf.com top 100?
89th.
No, it's just not even close to being in it. It didn't receive any votes to be in. So what I'm getting at, and Shadow Creek, I think the first time that it got in the ranking, it was like 7.
We could have a whole podcast on Shadow Creek.
We could. And Shadow Creek has some cool stuff about it. 90%. But it debuted at like 7th or 8th or 9th. It was ranked ahead. And this is just all out blasphemy of the highest order. It was ranked ahead of National Golf Links the first year it was in there.
Hitting me.
Dead ass. And now it's like, you know, 30th, which is about 200 spots higher than it should be in the Golf Digest ranking. And it is somewhere in the back end of the golf.com top 100. It is one of the four or so courses that people would probably say are top 100 courses that Foz has designed. And that's in the US, as we said, in the golf.com, no top 100 internationally. But the point is that, you know, it's a restaurant. You go, and the first time you're like, man, that was good. I liked it. It was really solid. And then you go again, and either the first time it was just recency bias, or it was novelty, or whatever it was, you know, whatever kind of tickled your fancy that first go round, it's just not quite there the second time. And the third time it's a little worse, and the fourth time it's a little worse. And then the fifth time you're like, you know what? We're just not coming back. And it's so sad that so many of his courses seem to be that way, that people early in the game seem to think that they are really good. And I don't know if it's that people start to recognize that the course isn't as good as they thought it was the first time they went around it, or if they start to see other things and recognize by comparison, there's just a lot better stuff out there. But that's a sad piece of it all to me, that his courses, rather than grow on people, seem to get worse. Because I think a lot of the courses that do absolutely have this term posterity, they grow on you. You know, San Francisco Golf Club, A.W. Tillinghast in San Francisco.
Posterity.
Bit of an oxymoron. First time around, I remember thinking like, yeah, this place is good. I like it. Very solid. I'm not buying the whole like top 30 in the US sort of ranking. Now that I've played it, you know, many, many times, I mean, I love the place. It is so good. It might be underrated overall. I mean, you talk about a place that fits in its nook, the boot fits and everything feels as if it should be. I mean, you cannot beat it. It is so unbelievable. And man, that's a cool thing to be able to grow on someone. Like, think about that as a person. If you're that guy that people love hanging out with the first time, and then the fifth time, it's like, man, I really don't want to go grab a drink with that guy. Versus the guy that it's like, you know what? I've enjoyed every time I've been with him a little bit more, you know, and I want to spend more time around that guy.
Makes a big
man. Impact. I want to be the second guy. I big really impact. Want to be the second guy. I don't want to be surf and turf.
It's a hot take. I like that. It's good stuff. Yeah. SFGC is like a well-worn glove. I'm trying to think of another just golf course.
Better
like
with
that.
Age.
I think Roaring Gap is a little bit like that too. Just play it once and it's pretty good. But I think it's the courses that are kind of subtle too. They don't have any waterfalls. There's no BS to them. It's the courses that it's the difference in the way they play with the weather and the seasons. And I think there's some the consistency to them, but the small incremental differences that change the way your round goes, I think that has something to do with it. The architecture, of course. But I think the architecture allows for those differences. And boy, it's a good take.
So we're starting to lose our train of thought here a little bit, but I do want to finish with a question, which is, what has Fazio done for just golf in general? You know, for the cat, let's not talk about for the big time PGA Tour events and the competitive golfer. Clearly, you know, freaking caves. I know it's soft out there, but it's everything that it goes against everything that we want to see fixed in golf of, oh, we want it to not have to be 8,000 yards and people not shoot a million under. And yeah, freaking caves is like 7,600 and people are taking it 25 deep through three rounds. So clearly it's not working for tournament play, at least in terms of where we want the game to go. But what has Fazio done for just kind of the average casual golfer?
Yeah, it's a hard question.
Great.
Yeah, no, I'm serious.
Trying to go to bat for old surf and turf and just nothing.
I mean, it is. I mean, we talked about the problems that we really care about in golf. Like, go back to base one, which is golf is too expensive for the average American. It takes too much time to play and takes a while to learn, whatever. I mean, there are a number of problems, but those are really the big ones. And, you know, I just looked up Fazio Public Golf. There aren't a lot of options. And and we know how expensive these projects are and how they contribute. They certainly don't fall on the ownership. They fall on the people paying the fees. So man, I don't know. I mean, he built a lot of golf courses, which means that there were a lot of people that got to play golf because of Tom Fazio. And I think that is a positive thing. But I think another really, really important thing to bring up is what a challenge it is to overturn country club boards these days on very, very simple issues such as tree removal or simple changes in architecture problems that are beneficial towards the budget, towards enjoyment, towards kids playing, towards women playing the game. And I think part of the reason that some of these arguments are so hard to win is because of the number that Fazio did on the generation before us. And I don't think that is largely their fault. I think it is just the golf courses that were around that were the standard, that were considered good in the generation before us. And Fazio has a lot to do with that. So I'm not purely against Fazio. I think there are many others who are, who did exactly what he did. I just think that he's the easiest target. And so, yeah, that's my take.
Well, I'm going to try to finish, and I mean this seriously, but I'm going to try to finish with something that won't sound overly flattering to Fazio, and it probably isn't. But I do mean it in a positive manner. And, you know, we're entering a time when, you know, younger golfers probably won't necessarily have to do this. But if we look at the people who frequent the game today, the average age of a golfer is 41 years old. And so if we just go off that average, it certainly applies to what I'm about to say, which is that I do think that Fazio courses had no long, probably not as much have, but had a place within someone's journey through golf course architecture, knowledge, passion, et cetera, which is to say, so many people, especially those who don't grow up in extremely privileged backgrounds and, you know, play an A.W. Tillinghast or Seth Rayner or Donald Ross or George Thomas course as, you know, their first golf course, that grow up on public places, they probably went through a period of time where they played golf because it was kind of fun and they went out with their friends. And then all of a sudden you get a little bit more into it. And, you know, you might play at some resort that's a little bit nicer and you're like, I kind of like this. This is pretty cool. And then you start to play some nicer courses. And at some point along that train, you start to play some Fazio places and you're like, wow, this is really nice. This is beautiful. Yes, it's expensive, but golf can be like this really nice thing, you know, and the aesthetic appeal and the way that Fazio sorts of courses are manicured. I think that has done a lot to draw people into the game. You know, it gives people a different perception of what golf can be. Now, that's kind of where the train ends, and it leaves that station to go on to okay, now you play one of those sorts of golden age courses and you're like, whoa, this manicuring is like just as good. And like, oh man, those mowing lines are like, there's some shit to that, you know, like
there's
a little different. Bit more intrigue. Oh my God, I have to think about this in a little bit different way. Like, and I just hit that shot that I really intended to, that my caddy told me, because I'm going to have this like angle, like that I learned that in math class. I've never used that on a golf course, but I'm gonna have a better angle in. And like, oh my God, that shot was like so much easier, and I was rewarded for it, you know?
Right.
And okay, now it's coming full circle and you're like, there's more to it than that. However, maybe that golfer never gets to that round or that place in their journey if it hadn't been for those Fazio courses where they said, man, golf is like, this is fun. You know, I can go spend 5 hours, which is way too long, but I can go spend this amount of time with my friends on this like really cool, pretty manicured piece of property.
Right.
That means something. It absolutely does. If it means nothing more than that, then we accomplished something there with surf and turf, baby.
With surf
and turf. That's all we got for you. Mudball Monday.
We out.
Peace.